Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Salieri Report. It is my great privilege and pleasure to welcome back Dr. Peter Bregan, somebody who I'm so grateful. Peter, I'm so grateful you're in my life. I was thinking that walking over to the studio this afternoon, I was saying, thank God for Peter Bregan. And, you know, when I first learned about you, I was so impressed. And it never occurred to me when I first learned about you that I would have the honor of calling myself friend. So anyway, but thank you for joining us on the Salieri Report. We're going to be talking about a topic that I've fretted about for quite a while now. And it's called Mass Hypnosis Decoy for the Digital Concentration Camp. And as you know, I'm very concerned about helping people back out of the digital concentration camp before it slams its doors on them. And I think mass hypnosis is, you know, is talking them into staying on the couch while the trap, you know, while the trap snaps into place. Anyway, before we begin, I just want to talk a little bit about you, because I keep saying you have a 31-page resume, but I printed it out. It's 31 pages. I to talk about this theory of mass hypnosis, I felt it was extremely important to have somebody who had impeccable credentials. I'm an investment banker. I'm not a psychoanalyst. I'm not a psychiatrist. I don't have, you know, graduate degrees in psychology. But if you ask me who I know that has the most impressive resume in these fields, it's you. In addition to having published many, many books to making this field accessible to, you know, people all over the world. And finally, if you ask me who has the most impeccable credentials standing up to abuse of the use of psychiatry to harm people, it's you. My first comment after I learned about you was, oh my God, I can't believe he's alive.
Well, they tried to make it so I wouldn't be years ago, but they missed.
Well, but here's the thing. You are a brilliant man with a very high emotional IQ. If you look at your resume, I mean, your intellectual accomplishments are astonishing. And we'll put up a link so you can read all 31 pages. But you also have an amazingly high emotional IQ, and you also have a fabulous wife.
Oh my God, do I ever, yes.
And between the two of you, you write beautifully. And it's just amazing your ability to assemble intellectual content, integrate it, and present. So you're pretty much a pretty unique and special person. So just
God bless you. We feel the same way about you.
So
we're so glad to have you in our lives. We just are so glad to have you in our lives.
Well, we're all in cahoots here. So just give us a 5-sentence blurb on your many accomplishments in psychiatry and psychology. Can you do a short one?
I can do a short one. There's a before Ginger and an after Ginger. I've been with Ginger for almost 40 years, but I had a probably 30 years before then of doing active things in the world. I think first I got started in psychiatry. I was probably going to be a lawyer. I was in a special program at Harvard. That was an honors program in American history and literature. It was sort of a conduit to being a professor or perhaps a lawyer. I couldn't think of a lot of other things. And a friend of mine invited me out to the local state mental hospital. And it was a stunning experience for me to see the wretchedness of the lives of the people in the hospital, and that these were human beings like me. And for whatever reason, I wasn't closed off to the fact that I was a vulnerable person, that life was difficult for me, and I'd spent a lot of time thinking about things and reading psychology back in high school and stuff like that. And other kids didn't do those things back in the 50s. You know, we didn't read outside the curriculum a lot in high school in those days. And I just thought to myself, there before the grace of God go I. I couldn't handle these situations. I couldn't live in these wretched halls with these horrible aides who were clearly insensitive and brutalized themselves. And then I learned about shock treatment. I became the leader of the program eventually. I learned about shock treatment. I actually had the keys, stole the keys from that they gave me one day to walk around. I just kept them, and I could go anywhere in the hospital. Everybody thought I might belong there to go anywhere. Maybe the thought the superintendent gave them to me because I was really around that hospital a lot. I spent more time there than in my studies, for sure. And even the summers. In the summers, I got research money to stay for the summers and work in the hospital. And it became clear to me that the nearest thing, the nearest analogy to this state mental hospital was the extermination camp, the concentration camps.
Really?
And I had seen films when I was 9 years old that changed my life. Just by accident, we were going to a family movie show, and Movie Tone News showed the liberation.
Right.
And I was probably 9 and a half years old, maybe something like that. And then not long after, Michael Dutch came back from the war and told me too much about what it was like when he entered these camps and the torture chamber. So I had it emblazoned on me that I'm a Jew and this is what can be done to Jews. It was just boom. And when I walked into the state mental hospital, it stank the way my uncle had talked about the concentration camps. The people were cowed and hopeless looking, just like he described. The people who were running the place, that's a different image from later on when I learned more about the actual extermination state mental hospitals in Nazi Germany. Because they began with exterminating patients in the state mental hospitals. So I just thought, this is what I'm supposed to do. And then I eventually went pre-med. I wrote, co-authored my first book and about the mental hospital experience, and got to know a lot of Harvard professors. One professor supervised the program and decided to go to medical school. And I had a lot of reinforcement at that point from big psychiatric professors at Harvard who had, at that point, these guys weren't facing what psychiatry was really doing to people, but they were developing social concepts and psychoanalytic concepts and psychological concepts. So they were like wings to the program. There's a Marxist wing, Marxist psychiatry. I mean, you had all these different things going on that were interesting. And I thought I would have a place to get in there and reform this and stop this kind of thing. Well, that changed almost totally around 1955, 56, because that's when the state mental hospitals got flooded with the new lobotomizing drugs, many of which people are taking. If you're taking Abilify or Seroquel and a whole bunch of other drugs, Zyprexa, they lobotomize, they disrupt frontal lobe function. So they made the hospitals quiet.
Right.
And after that, psychiatry went totally pharmaceutical. And it's a history I've tracked. I haven't even published it, I don't think, yet, on that whole history of knowing they were giving neurotoxins, knowing that these harmed people, harmed monkeys, harmed young men, whoever you gave them to, but that they subdued the patients. So again, here's psychiatry is the cutting edge of this mind control thing, which I had no idea about at the time. I never got to reform the state mental hospitals, but by the time I was finishing up my training, I no longer saw a conventional place for myself in psychiatry because it had become so corrupted by the drug companies. I was at NIMH 2 years before Fauci entered NIAID, which is also, and NIMH and NIAID are branches or divisions of the National Institutes of Health. And I quit. I got offered a great job to stay and work in the children's unit, which was the only decent place at NIMH that I could find. But I decided I can't do this. You have to become a drug company person to do this. And it's interesting. So Fauci comes along 2 years later and joins NIH and joins the drug companies.
Right.
So our tracks just diverged completely, although we were only 2 years apart. I'm 2 years older than he is, about approximately anyway. And so I went into private practice, and then I'm in practice. I'm not taking on big issues scientifically, particularly. I've written some scientific papers already, even though I'm a kid. young man. And I find out lobotomy's coming back. And I decided that this was not allowable. I could not be related to the field, even though I was basically doing psychotherapy. I had to get in there and stop lobotomy. And I thought I'd have allies in psychiatry. I just got attacked by every single authority within psychiatry. I worked with women's groups. I worked with Black groups. I worked with the Black Caucus because they were operating on little Black children in Mississippi. And because they wanted to apply this, they were claiming Harvard professors, William Sweet, arguably the most powerful, respected man in American medicine, not psychiatry, medicine, neurosurgeon William Sweet, he was arguing that Black leaders had brain damage and we needed to lobotomize them and do surgeries on their brains. Jesus. And it was, and nobody, I'm reading this stuff, that was actually written into an article in the JAMA, German American Medical Association. So I started writing and I started organizing and I had to do it entirely outside the profession. And it was astonishing to me to realize that the whole profession was never going to acknowledge how bad the stuff I saw in the state mental hospital was, because I saw the lobotomized patients, I saw shock treatment being given, I saw the blunting, disastrous effects of shock treatment. So I became the conscience of psychiatry.
Right.
I actually organized such an amazing thing back then, because you could work with Congress then.
Right.
And you could get some media then. And I stopped them around the world pretty much.
So I just have to stop you for a second and say, if you go to Solari and put in mind control, you'll get a commentary full of links that are mind control tactics used on young people and everyone else. And in those links is one of my favorite documentaries in the world. True Stream Media is The Minds of Men. And that's how I first learned about your work. Is they tell part of the story, and it's, you know, first of all, you have to see that documentary, but you really have to see the part about Peter, because that's the one where I said, how is he still alive? So it's an astonishing accomplishment what you did.
And it was incredibly lonely, which is interesting. Right. And so that was probably the major pre-Ginger accomplishment. And then Ginger and I got together. And by the way, I went from there. People said, Peter, look what you've done. You got to take on shock treatment. You got to take on the drugs. And I gradually evolved the principle that all psychiatric treatments only work to the extent you want a brain damaged person. That's it.
Wow.
The drugs, the shock treatment, the psychosurgery, they all cause brain dysfunction at the least. Right. And you can't put years of brain dysfunction into somebody with a neurotoxin without doing them harm that they won't necessarily escape from ever.
Right.
And it's just a simple thing that people don't realize. In order to get a psychiatric drug approved, you have to show that it's going to have specific effects on the brain of an animal. Well, those effects are all neurotoxic.
Right.
So you're not curing anything in the animal. You're just causing a biochemical imbalance often in particular neurotransmitters that we have a tradition and a history of causing dysfunction in, like serotonin and dopamine. Particular ones we just love to do that, and we find that can be done, and then the FDA says, okay, you can try it on some people now, just a small number, and doesn't kill anybody, you can go on to the next stage.
But you kept practicing and you kept writing books helping people be healthy and mentally healthy. And
I'm so glad we go to that part.
You became a teacher of mental health.
And it was a strange progression, because I was, in the beginning, thought I was a progressive. And I was in the middle of the campaign, and no progressives were really supporting my work very much. The people on the left, Ted Kennedy became a mortal enemy.
Really?
Oh, my God, yeah. And I found out why. He was the head of the health committee. So I couldn't do much in the Senate. And right. I was working, writing legislation. I eventually actually got passed legislation for a psychosurgery commission, which actually declared psychosurgery experimental, which was a major accomplishment. Wow. But I got a brown envelope with pictures of Rosemary Kennedy lobotomized and little snippets of the records and everything. So I knew they'd lobotomized Rosemary. And I threatened Ted Kennedy. I sent them a threat through Anderson, the great columnist who had been covering me a little bit for threats against my life, actually. I said, I'm going to release the Rosemary crap if you keep standing in my way and preventing me from getting the psychosurgery commission. And I think you ought to hold psychosurgery meetings. So I got back. Okay.
Wow.
And he went ahead and he held these meetings on psychosurgery, but didn't invite me. So I sent him another message through Jack Anderson saying, I was so tough in those days. I sent him another message to Jack Anderson saying, I'm going to hold a press conference outside your meeting if you don't have me in. And then he attacked me, which was a big mistake because he was not a very bright guy, Ted Kennedy. He attacked me and it was quite a drama.
But anyway.
Eventually, when Ginger joined me, things got bigger. Ginger thinks more like you. She's really got a big, she's just interested in everything.
Uh-huh.
And I had enough training to be this interested in more narrow things.
Right.
So we'd been together for quite a while and she started to work with me. They went after my medical license and Ginger was actually going to college. She'd never had the chance to go to college. So my wife could go to college. She could do anything she wanted. So she started college. By the way, her first class, she managed to get into a graduate school course, not an undergraduate. It was her first class. And then she won the whole American University prize for the best social sciences paper. So who'd I marry here?
She's a remarkable researcher.
she's just a thinker too.
Right.
And I'm giving a speech somewhere. Ginger calls me on the phone. I think I'm out in talking to this to a religious group out in the Midwest, to the Mormons, to their national council, trying to convince them to not drug their kids in their clinics and stuff.
Right.
And and she calls me and says, the head of an organization that doesn't exist anymore, that was the umbrella organization for all the mental health organizations. And the head of it was a guy, God's blocking on his name, but we wrote a whole book about what he was doing. But he, Fred Goodwin, he had apparently announced at a meeting something very racist and about the black people were like monkeys in a jungle. They just want to have sex, reproduce, and kill each other. At a big conference, he announced this to support his new project to end violence in the inner cities.
What year was that?
1994.
That's when they were passing the laws that created the private prisons.
Yes,
they were dropping SWAT mm-hmm. teams into black neighborhoods, rounding up the kids and stuffing them into prison. Everybody's making money on the gentrification, the real estate, and on the prison stocks.
I never knew that.
Yeah, that's what my online book is about. I know a lot about this. So there's a lot of
there's a cross here.
Yeah. There's a lot of cross. Yeah.
Well, I said, I'm too busy and I'm flying to England across the pole and I don't know about this. And well, when I got back, she totally organized the thing. She'd gotten in touch with John Conyers, the Black Caucus, reminded them of all the work I'd done with their predecessors years uh-huh. earlier. She got John Conyers, who was the head of the Black Caucus, to get the written form of the speech. And it turns out to be something much worse than just racism. He's organizing every agency he can find, from the FBI and the everybody, all the health people, all of them into a program to go into the inner city and do biological research on Black children to find out why they're so violent. And he's going to start in utero.
So let's hold that thought, because I do want to talk about mass hypnosis, but this happens.
Well, we can even stop there.
Okay, but I just want
it.
You
Ginger stopped that program.
Fantastic, because
with little help from me. Go ahead.
I contributed to stopping it too, believe it or not.
No, I didn't know.
Yeah, so I have to tell you about that, but we won't talk about that today. But I just realized we have a whole new chapter to write together.
Oh God.
Anyway, so let me jump ahead.
By the way, let me just say, we wrote a book about that called The War Against Children of Color. And it's not really much available, but there's a lot on our website, bregan.com, about this, about all this stuff.
I will go look it up.
Go to the psychiatry section.
The War Against the Children of Color. Okay. Yeah. Because there was a war. And it was... they were fixing to do something pretty radical, and a lot of people stopped them. Apparently, you were one. I was one.
No, we organized the whole damn thing. We discovered it. We promoted it. We went to the press about it. We took 3 years out of our lives. I testified before Congress about it. I testified for the Black Caucus. And this was like our project for several years.
That's fantastic, Peter. And that was very dangerous.
I think we've been protected so far. Thank you, God.
Yeah.
They have tried. They've tried a few very bad things. But
so now we're on our next roll to stop the next evil thing, which I believe is mass hypnosis. You ready?
I'm ready. Now, I got to make something clear so people don't get confused. The concept that he uses is mass formation.
Well, it's mass. I thought it was mass hypnosis formation.
No, it's mass formation. It's a bizarre bunch of words, mass formation. But you're absolutely right that one of his underlying theories is that it's hypnosis. He's got like 10 theories. He throws them against the wall and hopes one will stick in your eye and you'll remember it. But it is mass formation, and it's not transformation, just formation. And it's a bizarre theory. But one of the major aspects of it is that supposedly it's hypnosis. But we can start to talk about that now if you want.
Okay, so this started, I think, about a year ago, where a professor from Belgium, whose name is Matthias Desmet, started to talk about something called mass formation. I keep hearing it as mass hypnosis formation.
Yeah, people may be saying that, but it is not in the book.
It's mass formation. And he did interviews which evolved and over time. And then he has finally written a book describing this theory. And you have written a book review. We're going to put a link up with it. And Ulrich Garniger, interestingly enough, also wrote a book review. So both will be linked. And this theory tries to explain the behavior of many people who were in a state of fear during the COVID-19 pandemic. And this theory explains why we are supportive of totalitarianism. So why don't I have you explain what the exact theory is of mass formation?
Well, there is no exact theory of mass formation because it's a hoax. And its purpose is only to stop people from digging deeply into the global predators who are behind it.
Right.
The entire idea is very similar. Well, he's a psychoanalyst, and his whole idea is very similar to what Freud did with the Oedipus complex. And Freud's the head of psychoanalysis. It's a cult. Psychoanalysis is a cult. And Freud was the head of the cult. And Freud discovered that children, that most of the women who were coming to see him, maybe almost all of them, but there were small numbers, he was doing individual work with women, that they had been abused sexually as children, and that their symptoms of paralysis or whatever else, blindness, went back to sexual abuse. And he explained this one day to a group of physicians. It may have been the last time any group of physicians ever listened to him. He became totally outside the establishment. And they, and these are these Victorian guys with their black hats and their little black suits, right, and just diddling their children and whatever else, with it, beating their wives or whatever with impunity, because there's no concepts then, right, really, of child abuse or women, abuse of women and so on. And Freud didn't, was not going to go in that direction. Other people did. Alfred Adler, who was working with Freud and left Freud, wrote an amazing book on the liberation of women. So it's not like you couldn't see it if you looked.
Right.
And Freud, in a series of letters to a close friend of him who was a pretty crazy guy, Jeffrey Mason is actually a friend of mine, but Jeffrey would want me to say whose politics differ vastly now from mine because he's very much on the left. Jeffrey wrote an amazing book about the betrayal of the patients. And because he found, he was high up in the psychoanalytic ranks before he quit them, and he found these letters actually in Freud's daughter's cabinet in her home. And he wrote about, got permission, he wrote about these letters. And Freud writes about all the humiliation he's felt, that, I mean, he's done in the medical community for drawing off the curtain and child abuse. And then he says, and besides, I think I'm wrong. He says, I think it's the children's fantasies. In fact, I know it evolves. So within 3 or 4 months, he formulates the Oedipus complex, right, which is that children lust after their parents so intensely, these primitive sexual instincts, which is all BS.
Right.
And that they make up stories of being abused. That's right. Oedipus complex.
Right.
So he builds this framework for a cult, and it's crazy, like a lot of cult frameworks, because it was the most important.
But it gives air cover to the predators.
Exactly.
Right.
And I don't think it's a coincidence that they picked Desmond to do this, or Desmond picked himself to do this, because that's what his book does. That's all his book does. And today I was looking at a particularly interesting series of items on page 92 of the book. And in it, he is saying that it can't be a conspiracy theory, COVID-19, because, and he gives his definition, not a bad definition, but conspiracy theory being malicious planning and strategizing in secret. And then he says, well, you see, it can't be a conspiracy theory because it's not in secret. Why, it's all over the internet, all these ways they were planning it. And so I was debunking this this morning, just writing that, well, first of all, it took me, over a year of working 7 days a week to find the master plan, which we describe in our book, COVID-19,
yeah,
the global predators, right, the master plan from 2015, and then to find the PowerPoint from the same group that was run by Bill Gates to the World Health Organization, dividing up the world and the coming pandemic. And so I said, no, it wasn't all in the open. And secondly, all violent, terrible people signal to some extent what they're doing.
Right.
They do it all the time.
Right.
Hitler wrote a book about what he was going to basically do. So, and of course, the Iranians and the Iraqis, the Iranians are clear what they're going to do to Israel. Not going to be any surprise they drop an atomic bomb on Israel. These people always, always signal. And furthermore, they had to organize. So where are they signaling? They're signaling by doing practice sessions.
Right.
And they're signaling by speaking out at conferences. They're trying to get support and get organized. So they got to,
right,
do,
but
some
also
signaling.
If you look at the tremendous amounts of money that were moved around secretly funded covert operations, the covert operations were very, very significant.
That's right.
Right. Right.
So, and I think
there's plenty of secrecy. Yeah, there's on the financial side, there's tons
of,
there's $21 trillion missing from the U.S. government. It's all secret. No one will answer the questions about who has it, where it is, you know. So there's the financing on the financial side. There's plenty of secrecy. But the other thing is, if I engage in a RICO conspiracy and I talk about it, it's still illegal. It's still a crime. I can still help be accountable. It's still a conspiracy. I mean, a RICO, by definition, is a conspiracy.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I think that's really, really important.
Right.
What you're saying. But he's trying to do, this is for the public. And he's trying to dismiss it for the public, I think, is what he's trying to do, not the lawyers. But it was interesting because Ginger then, we were getting ready for the show and I wrote this and Ginger looked down and she said, "This is the heart of his book, honey." Well, I didn't exactly know what that meant. I went to the bathroom and then I realized, oh my God, I know what she's saying. And what she was saying was that the heart of the book is to stop things like any of these lay people and other people bringing conspiracy theories. They won't even try them because you can't, he's dismissing them, and to discredit in advance, you know, the things that our mutual friend in Germany, Reiner Fulnitsch, right, is doing. So there it was right there.
So let me mention a couple of things because
I haven't given his theory yet.
Oh, go ahead. Give his theory. Right.
So what is his theory? He has about 5, 6, 7 theories because there's no science behind it. One of his most beautiful theories is he compares it to the murmurations, I think they're called, of starlings. He said, all these people got so frightened, they moved in unison. Well, how can people move in unison? So he gives, there's the starlings moving in unison. And he said, and it's more than just communication, it's something biological, kind of oscillating cells. And he goes into all this BS because he doesn't have anything. Then he goes in and he talks about mass hypnosis. But mass hypnosis requires a leadership intent on hypnotizing you.
Right.
You have to have an authoritarian. And then his basic ideas come out of the madness of crowds. And so all his major examples of these terrible things that crowds do, including the entire, quote, French Revolution, which did have certainly a lot of madness of crowds in it, including the Crusades and all those other things. So I have a lot of fun because I point out that making people disturbed during COVID-19 could not have happened in crowds, my friend, because we were all isolated. Parentheses not said, you idiot. Now, there's another more pernicious part of the theory, which is what I think he's really aiming at. He says that some people get all this craziness and they do it to themselves in some strange hypnotic fashion or like birds or like whatever else. He says, but then there are the people who are watching all this happen, i.e. the intellectuals, and this freaks them out, which is true. Many of my friends are freaking out about how crazy the other doctors are, all these doctors lockstep, right, all these people lockstep. He said, and those people make up conspiracy theories to assuage their needs. And that's psychoanalysis again. You have instinctual needs. You mm-hmm. have to assuage them. In fact, all art and creativity is nothing more than sublimating your sexuality. And love is fake. He believes that love does not exist. It's a weird sublimation of the sexual instinct. And no man over 40 still loves his wife. I mean, it makes it weird. There's a weird guy, Freud. So the essential point is that you and I and all the other people who are thinking for ourselves about what's going on behind the scenes are mentally disturbed. We have overwhelming needs to simplify things by making up a conspiracy theory, as if that's simplifying things. He's simplifying things. These conspiracy theories take incredible intelligent work. And you have to I've been a slave to studying what's going on. And the last thing I expected to find was a damn conspiracy. I didn't believe in those myself. I'd been brainwashed. And all of a sudden I find this is happening. I mean, I was nowhere where you were. I mean, I've testified in court over 100 times. You don't testify in courts in the United States and Canada if you have vulnerable theories of any kind, because they just dismiss you.
Oh, they eat you alive.
They eat you alive. So it tends to control partly how you think. And then also my work as a psychotherapist, you know, the biggest conspiracy theories I'd get into is, you know, what were your parents doing to you that you don't remember when you were 5 years old?
Well, but the other thing is, if you read your books, you're heavily footnoted. I mean, you really you like to build the Global Predators has a lot of footnotes.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
When and that was the work that Ginger and I did together. I do the writing. She's writing now. She's a great writer. She's finally writing after 40 years of us together.
So I have to tell you just a little tangent. Once upon a time, when I was still knowing and hanging out with the guys who did covert operations, they would, you know, because then I was an insider, and they would do years of planning and work. It was hard work to engineer some big move, particularly financial moves. It took a lot of money, time, planning, you know, organization, things went wrong, you know, to move all the money from here to there. And then they'd sit and watch some commentator explain it like it was a natural, spontaneous event.
Yes, yes.
And they would go, oh, God, if they only, you know, because they used to feel like, I used to say they made the Soprano TV show just because they wanted credit for how hard it was.
Oh, God.
It's like, you know, and can you, and but they would laugh. Can you believe anybody believes this is a spontaneous event? This is thousands of people and years of work, you know. And
and everybody's behaving the same throughout the world. All the professionals, all the scientists, all the journals, they're all saying the same stupid things over and over again. And he acknowledges some of that, which is what endears him to some of our friends who should have looked more deeply.
I think people are watching something and they know something deeply irrational is happening. And there is, it does remind you of somebody who's in a hypnotic trance. And so it's almost like a safe way to admit there's something, you know, I don't think they want to look dead in the mirror and say, you know, something, we're dealing with military grade neurological weapons here.
Yes.
I don't think they want to say that. And I don't think they want to face that their smartphone is delivering neurological military grade weapons. You know what I mean?
God. Yes, I know what you mean, but I don't know it as well as you do. So we need to talk more about it.
So we definitely need to talk about it. But one of the things, the thing that was astonishing to me about, because it wasn't astonishing that anybody was promoting such a theory. What was astonishing was that anybody was doing anything other than laughing.
Yeah.
And the reason is, you know, we did a 12-part series called Deep State Politics, and it was all on the nuts and bolt tactics that are used. So we describe all the tactics, and I'll aggregate them into three lines. So the digital systems that do surveillance and entrainment and subliminal programming. So they're collecting data, but they're also delivering subliminal messages and entrainment. Okay, so that's one line. Then the financial nuts and bolts. There's tremendous amounts, you know, and you saw it with COVID, how much a hospital would get paid for registering something as a COVID case or a COVID death or, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So there's an enormous amount of nuts and bolts, and money is used in very granular ways. And every person is tracked. I mean, this is being tracked on a one person at a time basis. People are being manipulated on a one person. And then you have the covert operation. So you and I both know stories of whistleblowers who don't go along and suddenly turn up dead or drowned or, you know, blah, blah. So you have the surveillance and the mind control. You have the money. And we've watched $10 trillion printed by the central bank since the going direct reset started. So that's a tsunami of money. And you've seen how much the doctors have had money thrown at them to buy them in. And then you have the covert operations, you know, and we continue to see assassinations and shootings daily. Yeah. Right. So that's a lot of force, whether it's legal force, financial force, physical force. We're watching massive force to herd people into a position where they will mouth the official narrative. And so now they all jump in the corral of the official narrative. Many do. They jump in the corral of the official narrative. And suddenly this guy comes along and says, oh, they've had a spontaneous eruption of this theory, of this, that it is, they have created this out of their fear, as opposed to being herded like livestock, one cow at a time, into the corral.
That's right. Yeah, and then, you're very aware of this, but didn't happen to mention that doctors who stepped out of line, threatened with licensure loss, losing their licenses. One of my close colleagues who helped me really understand a lot of stuff early on is now losing her license. This, and psychologists who stood up, I'm talking to one who's losing their life, trying to take their license away. This, and then you get to like McCullough, who's one of the braver men in the history of the world. Well, we have two really brave men, McCullough, and now our deceased friend, Zev Zelenko, dear friend
Zelenko.
Of mine.
Zelenko. Unfortunately, persecuted. McCullough and I had a bad run-in. He was promoting vaccines, so we had a bad run-in.
Oh, in the early days.
In the early days, but, you know.
You don't promote him anymore.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like. And but I thought Zelenko was a great, one of the great
heroes.
Yeah,
well, both these men were totally disenfranchised. That shows you the conspiracy is there. I mean, the forces are there. Zelenko, as soon as he started talking about hydroxychloroquine, the governor outlawed hydroxychloroquine. He was the only one talking about it. Eventually, there was so much stirred up against him in his community that he had to leave his Jewish Orthodox community.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yes. No. And then he went to upstate New York. He had to leave there. He finally went to Florida. Tremendous harassment. And then you have McCullough, who was more in the establishment. And that was so brave to stand up being in the establishment. He lost his professorships at Baylor. He lost his medical group to work with. They're going after other things. They're doing everything they can to destroy McCullough. And I early on realized that I was very, very vulnerable. The APA went after my membership in the Psychiatric Association in 1972, 73 for attacking lobotomy.
Right.
I got a good lawyer, and before we were done, they were mumbling to themselves, and they never brought the charges.
Right. So if you look at all the, you know, I would say this is war, and the other side
World War III. It's really World War III.
It's World War III, and they go to extreme measures of legal, financial, and physical harassment and real terror. You know, everything is weaponized against you. And
you know, it is real terror. They make
terror.
People feel guilty. Like the common line that non-vaccine people run into is you're bad. You're going to get sick and expose other people. And then now injecting children, that has to be a violent, hateful, murderous group behind it, because children should never get a COVID vaccine. They should get COVID. Because it doesn't kill them. There's no death rate
and then
for
they're
children.
Immune. Then they get immune.
Then they're immune. Then they contribute to the community by having a generation grow up who's immune.
Right.
But they don't want that. They want to make everybody take a vaccine, both for two reasons, wealth and power. They get the wealth
and
they get
the
power.
I think it's worse than that.
Well, and they're killing people.
Right. I mean, you're...
It's mass
murder. I'll never forget reading a proposal that had been made on the Earth Charter in 1992 describing enforcing a population reduction program implemented country by country. Each country got a quota, and it would be implemented with a trade embargo and credit embargo. And if you look at what's happening, it looks exactly, you know, the proposal fits exactly the fact
patterns
we're watching.
I'd love to see that, by the way. That's not hard for you to find.
It was in a new book that's just about to be published. And as soon as they publish it, I'll send it to you. It was a proposal and it wasn't adopted. It was supposed to be implemented through the UN Security Council. It was what the proposal was proposing. It wasn't adopted. But it's so eerily like what's happening now. Mm-hmm. I'll send it. Okay, so let me
say, we didn't want to conclude the mass murder was going on. When Zev Zelenko, who wrote one of the introductions to our book, called it mass murder, I said, well, all right, I'd rather have him say it. By the end of the book, we had to acknowledge that this was intentional, because we found their intentions and connected it to their results and saw that the CDC, for example, won't even count the number of deaths and evaluate it. They've actually stated now in a Freedom of Information response, they are not evaluating all the deaths they're getting. And they have more deaths. They had more deaths within hours.
You know, when I started,
go ahead.
You know, I started to use the word genocide when I saw the appendix in Mark Skidmore's survey. I don't know if you've read his survey yet, but he published at the beginning of the year a survey where he did a survey. He used Leslie Mnookin and Saleri's email list to test the survey. And then he put it to a professional survey firm and went out to 3,000 people who are supposed to be representative of the population. And one of the last questions in the survey was, how many people do you know who've been harmed or injured by COVID-19 injection? And then they would answer that question and they'd say, take the person you know the best of that group. Describe in one sentence what happened. And in Appendix C, it aggregates all the responses. And it's just, myocarditis, pericarditis, stroke, death, fast-acting cancer. It's just one after another after another. And it goes on for pages and pages. And you realize, this is genocide.
I think it is. It's culling.
Culling. It's culling.
Especially get rid of the old and right. and the infirm, because they're a weight on our social security, our social support
system.
Well,
what they're doing is they're balancing the actuarial table. So in other words, they can't afford the retirements. So you
exactly.
simply, you reduce, if you reduce life expectancy, you bring the retirements back closer into balance. Okay, so let me go back, because I believe that they have been building this control grid with digital systems for 30 years, and it's gotten more and more invasive and more surveillance, more and more control, but it won't give them complete control until they get the digital ID and the CBDC. And once you have an all digital financial system, they can control everything. Whether or not, it's the mark of the beast from the Bible, literally. And they will have complete, and that's why I use the word digital control concentration camps, because they will turn your home into a concentration camp. They will turn your car into a concentration camp. They will turn your community into a concentration camp, and they're trying to get complete control of the food system. And so when you combine complete control of the food system, now, if you look at what was happening with COVID, those digital control systems were, they were getting more and more invasive, more and more invasive. And along comes the theory of mass formation as some kind of spontaneous eruption that is coming from
out
us.
Of the needs of the people.
The needs of the people.
Our primitive Freudian needs.
Our primitive Freudian needs are creating these authoritarian leaders who are simply trying to please us with their authoritarian things.
Oh, you got it exactly. That is just what he says.
I know. But
he says Hitler is not an avaricious, violent, awful person. He's a product of the masses. Oh, God, in the book.
Well, if you study the history of Wall Street, you'll know that there was a great deal of complicated, hardworking financing going into Hitler.
Hitler, oh, God, and into the Chinese and into the Russians and...
Right. So these things don't happen by spontaneous. I'm not saying spontaneous eruptions don't happen, but something.
No, they happen in crowds.
Right.
But when you got isolated people who aren't allowed to meet in crowds, it doesn't happen.
Anyway, so we have this spontaneous eruption. And if you believe this, then it results in two things, Peter. And this is where I think the frightening danger of anybody believing this happens. One is, you don't need to back out of the control grid. You don't need to worry about the control grid. You just need to shift your consciousness.
Exactly.
Because if the control grid is spontaneously erupting out of your consciousness, as opposed to being installed by AT&T, you don't have to worry about it. If you just change your consciousness, the authoritarianism will go away. That's number one. But number two, you don't have to do anything.
Yeah.
Because if a shift in consciousness is what will solve this, you can stay on your couch. And so it's what I call the story of I am good. See, if I just become good, I don't have to get up and do anything. I don't have to write a book about global predators. I don't have to, give a speech and try and stop this. I don't have to go see my state legislator. I don't have to talk to my local sheriff. I don't have to switch to, I don't have to do any of that stuff. I can stay on my couch. It's like QAnon. This is like the psychotherapist's QAnon. Does that make any sense? It
yes.
gives you permission to stay on the couch and do nothing.
Yeah.
It's extraordinary.
It's so important. And he actually he actually says that in his introduction. I mean, the way his introduction ends is the real task facing us as individuals and as a society is to construct a new view of man and the world. not a new identity, not to take on evil, not to fight for freedom, not to stand up for the Bill of Rights and the Constitution, but a new identity, living together. Why can't we just all get along?
Can you, do you have a little thing to strum kumbaya? So there's this word new I keep hearing. The Constitution is old. Let's go do a new thing. The retirement
that was done by the French Revolution.
Right.
They did their own they did a new thing.
So the retirement obligations are old. We need to do a new thing. You know, so if you look at all the rights we have and all the assets we have, the marketing keeps being, oh, we can leave those behind, we'll do a new thing. And what's interesting is there is you're starting to see amnesia of the fact that if you allow those rights to completely go away, then you're talking about the predators having complete free reign to do whatever they want. You're talking about taxation without representation, and you're talking about digital control. I mean, you're really talking about slavery.
That's right.
Right.
And it's a comparison that I find useful is between the American Revolution and the French. I'll do it briefly. And the American Revolution was conservative. It said, leave us alone, Great Britain. Right. We want to be free. We were free before. We'll even go back. We love the king. Just stop interfering with us. You had never done that before. And they fought until they got their freedom from England. They didn't transform and destroy the churches or existing states' governments. In fact, the French Revolution said, we're great European intellectuals. We're going to change everything and take down the church and take down private property. And that's exactly what they're talking about now. It's just that basic dichotomy between, are you protecting the rights of the individual, or are you going to impose your utopian vision where you're in charge, you're the great man, and you're doing all this stuff, and you get so destructive. And they ended up with Napoleon. They went from the rights of man to Napoleon.
Right. To me, I liken this very much to the Bolsheviks. You know, because the Bolsheviks
that's who comes next. Yes.
Right. The Bolsheviks talked a utopian game, and what they did was genocide.
Yeah.
So, right.
They all did. The French did genocide. And every Marxist has done it. This is all about utopianism. And I think the heart of it really goes, the French Revolution just shows it where, and everyone that follows goes like the French Revolution. We're really empire builders, and that's what they ended up doing. And we really want to kill a lot of people and get things under control and get rich and powerful.
So we come back to this philosophy of blaming the victim.
Yes.
And what I hear is something, a theory that says people are stupid and are easily cause authoritarianism to happen.
That's what he says, folks.
I know. Well, it's funny because my impression of the video interviews is he was never that bold. But the book, you know, when you put things down in black and white, you're forced to be clear.
But I could smell him from the interviews. First of all, I know how psychoanalysts think, and it's disgusting. And I could just hear him blaming the victim from the start. But, you know, that's been my life's work.
Right.
Psychiatry blames everything on the patient.
Right.
You give them shock treatment, they get memory loss. It's hysteria.
This is a kind of shock treatment or drugging, something like this.
Yeah.
So I was thinking of calling it the psychobabble of totalitarianism.
Well, it is like that. I call it psychologizing, but it is. That's a good description of the book. It's psychobabble. It doesn't deserve intellectual credence. It's amazing how he has gotten so many people.
Here's the interesting thing, because when I read the book, I had a hard time following it.
Yes, it doesn't make sense.
It reminded me of those fundraising letters that go on and on and on for pages. Do you know what I mean? They just go on for, you probably don't,
I don't
read
see,
them.
I don't see, nobody's coming to me for fundraising.
You
I got enough money to defend myself, folks, but they don't come to me for.
But you have three parts, and basically it's like an Oreo turd sandwich or something. You got the turd in the middle, and then you got these two parts. And if you look at the two parts on either side of the turd, they are designed to market to a series of people who love European, who love the history of culture, who love the history of intellectual thought, and who love, you know, everybody who loves Rupert Sheldrake or Lynn McTaggart and concepts of shared intelligence in the field are going to read these and think, oh, he's one of us.
Exactly.
Do you know what I mean? So the before and after look like they are designed to appeal to a certain variety of intellectuals, so to speak. And then right in the middle is this big fat turd.
Turd.
And what's interesting is there are a few tiny throwaways to the control grid. He mentions people didn't want to be fined by the government. And he has one paragraph where he says, oh, yeah, there are these things called vaccine passports. But that's almost like he wanted to, you know, he didn't want to, it would be too dangerous to say nothing about them.
Well, but, that's right. He just wants to look like he's really concerned about these risks and dangers.
Right.
That we're creating for ourselves.
But I couldn't find the logic in it. And so.
That's right.
It really felt like it was more of a two marketing pieces around the turd.
That's really good. But you've spoiled my lunch appetite, but it's really good.
Well, but it felt like it was written by a committee. I'm not saying it was written by a committee, but anyway.
It may have been. No, it may have been. I mean, who's behind this craziness?
I mean, I don't know.
I don't know the man's history, and I didn't want to spend a lot of time because he's just one more apologist.
Ulrich Groniger wrote a review of the book that we'll publish when we put up the link to yours. And she did a real search to try and find any kind of intellectual history to this theory, and there's none. It just spontaneously jumped up as popular science a year or two ago.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. And he's building on basically Le Bon's work on the madness of crowds.
Right, right, right.
But COVID has nothing to do with crowds because there weren't any.
So let me ask you this. I can understand why somebody might promote this theory or write this book. I can understand that. I can't understand why any intelligent person believes it or goes for it. That's what has shocked me.
Well, it has shocked me too, so I can't claim, oh boy, I just, you know, see through it all. But As a therapist and a person who, you know, really does care about human beings, which is better than being a therapist a lot, I saw in a number of my colleagues very early on when I got involved in the movement and I quickly started to meet some of the best people. They were very sweet, like yourself. I just recognized that I had something, whereas I'd been a pariah in the whole mental health field. All of a sudden, people were, oh, yeah, we love you, and saying to me, we loved your work in the mental health field. No one told me that when I was doing the mental health work. I was just getting attacked all the time. But almost everybody I'm working with is saying, oh, yeah, I read your book, talking back at Prozac. And so, but I saw such suffering in the eyes of my colleagues and my friends who just could not come to grips with the level of evil.
Right.
That would so freak out all and frighten the people around them. So it was both the level of evil and the frightening of the people around them. Well, you know, I grew up, knowing at the age of 9 that I could get slaughtered because I was Jewish.
Right.
Not because my parents told me, because I saw a film of it by mistake in the movies at
right.
the age of 9 of Jews being slaughtered. In Nazi Germany. So I think that one of the things I try to tell people is, look, human beings have always, since we've been in groups, been terribly violent toward each other. And there have always been leaders trying to destroy the rest of us, cull us, control us. We start living in groups 10,000 years ago, the Tigris-Euphrates, people have heard of that area, Mesopotamia, and
right.
basically a lot around where Israel and Palestine are now, and then Jordan. And it was a fertile crescent. It was an amazing area. And so people started living in towns and villages to escape the hardships of being hunter-gatherers for thousands and thousands and thousands of years, not prepared to live in villages. And you track it, and within 1,000 years of living in villages, they have walls around them.
Right.
Within 2,000 or 3,000 years, you start getting evidence of battles.
Right.
And 4,000 years, you have empires.
Right.
Very early progression. We became so vulnerable to being controlled by other people, something we never dealt with when we were going around as hunter-gatherers. So I try to tell people, this has been the fate of civilized humans. We have to wake up. Don't make believe that the Holocaust didn't happen. Don't make believe
right.
that people weren't being slaughtered in Vietnam and in Laos and the Cambodia. Don't make believe that the Iran really doesn't want to exterminate Israel. I mean, see the truth, see what is going on in the world and has always gone on. And right now, we haven't mentioned it, but behind so much of this, I'm sure you agree with me, is the Chinese Empire. Those people want to rule the world. And they've us Westerners zipping around them like honeybees.
Historically, the Chinese have been not external focused. You know, they've been much more internal focused. They have not been empire builders outside of their territory. If you look at what's happening now, what I see is tremendous financial interests in the West promoting the build out of China.
Oh my God, yes.
Right.
Good old Nixon opening China. China opened Nixon, took out his heart. China wanted to get into the World Trade Organization. China wanted, that was a part of the Chinese. And I don't think that Kissinger and Nixon played the role they thought they did.
Right, but I to this day, I see tremendous investment and support of China from the West.
Oh God, yes. Oh, yes.
Right.
It's in our book too, you know, we talk about that in the COVID.
Right.
And that was something I was, again, unprepared for. You know, the depth of, I did a lot of deep diving into what power does, because I was a medical expert against the big drug companies. But I never thought that was all of life until COVID-19, and I started looking.
So here's where I want to stop you. I don't know if you've ever read a book called Political Ponerology. It was by a fellow.
I have it upstairs. Ginger got it. We haven't read it yet.
So it was by a fellow who claimed to be have a PhD in psychology, who he'd lived through Hitler, and then Stalin came in. He was Polish. And he and his colleagues organized, and their way of dealing with what was happening was they said, we're going to do a deep study of how psychopaths find each other and use political mechanisms to control. We're going to study psychopathy in the political process.
Wow. I'll look at the book. Thank you. Go ahead.
And they wrote this is what he claims. They wrote the books three times, and three times they had to destroy it to protect themselves. And finally, when the wall came down, they were able to smuggle it out. And here's what he said. He said, a certain percentage of the population is born without empathy. So whether you call them psychopaths or sociopaths, but they're incapable of empathy. And they are excellent at finding each other and organizing for political advantage. And what happens is the rest of the human race cannot fathom that a few people don't have empathy. In other words, if I have empathy, I cannot fathom that you don't, or you might not. So it's very hard. And you'll see this with, I've seen this all my life with people dealing with real evil. They just can't fathom the other person is really channeling real evil. They just can't. Why would you want to be that?
That's
Why would you want to do, they can't, if you were capable of empathy, you can't fathom why somebody would behave that way.
Yeah.
Anyway, so what he says is that as long as the population can't fathom this dynamic, they are sitting ducks. The minute they fathom that this exists and it's real, then they start they stop letting the psychopaths make them neurotic, and they start using successful strategies and coping mechanisms once they break through. And that to me, Peter, is why it's so important that we all break through and say, yes, we're dealing with evil, but you know something? We can outwit evil. We can deal with evil. We can overcome evil, but first we have to face evil. And to me, anything that helps us avoid doing that puts us in great danger, because you can't avoid something if you can't face it. You know, I'm always quoting my old pastor. who used to say, if we can face it, God can fix it. If we can't face it, God can't fix it.
That's very nice. I like that.
Right.
Well, I'm with you 100%. You know, and again, in the book, I take something I developed earlier. I had a predator profile that I had developed for my legal work to distinguish between people who are systematically brutalizing other people because of how they are, right, versus people who get a bad hit on the head or take Prozac and do something terrible. There's a real difference between those people, the ones who are disrupted and freaked out by brain injury. And the globalists perfectly fit that predator profile. So I just took the predator profile in the book and then talked about it as global predators and what their profile is. And they're very much the opposite of the average person. They right. don't identify with country and nation. They don't have that kind of fellow feeling. So they easily become globalists. They don't believe in God. There's nothing superior to them to monitor them.
They're hyper-materialists.
They're actually a materialism is all they can think of because they don't have that empathy and caring. Right. Lately, I'm a little unsure about using this concept because I don't want to malign autistic people, but they have an autism toward the rest of the world. Not necessarily autistic themselves. They not necessarily can't see their wife or husband as a person, but they can't see the rest of the world as people.
Right.
So they may be different even than an ordinary psychopath. So I'm going to be interested in looking at the book. An ordinary psychopath cannot see their children as people. They're still objects.
Right.
The autistic person, they really are objects, but they don't necessarily hate them or want to hurt them. The autistic people are not by nature violent. So I want to look at the book, and it's going to be very interesting. The other thing is, you mentioned that they say it's genetic. I don't think we know what's genetic and what's nurture about in a lot of areas yet.
Right. I don't know.
I actually don't know in a lot of areas what's nature and what's genetic. But mostly the materialists want to think it's genetic. Often things are nurturing from very early. First months matter a lot in life. But I like what you're saying, and I want to look at it. But my own sense is that they don't fit the psychiatric psychopath thing necessarily. I don't know how Klaus Schwab relates to his wife or his kids, if he has them. Bill Gates, we know, did not relate very well to his wife, but it sounds like pretty ordinary marital misery. So I'm not sure whether these people don't have friends, but they certainly can't make friends with humanity. We are in the dark circle to be simply manipulated, used, conned, killed, culled.
So one of the reasons that I find this mass formation so offensive is in 2000, I moved to Hickory Valley, Tennessee. And I chose Hickory Valley, Tennessee because I wanted to go to a place that anybody in Washington, D.C. would consider it a complete demotion of their social prestige to be ordered to go there to do surveillance on me.
I wanted
to be in a place no celebrity would be seen. I wanted to be in a place where, on the social hierarchy, I was deemed to be at the complete bottom. And so that, again, none of the people torturing me would want to follow because they, you know, nobody wanted to say, oh, we were assigned to Hickory Valley, Tennessee. Anyway, I loved Hickory Valley, Tennessee, and I loved the people there. They're great people. And one of the reasons I love Hickory Valley is most everybody does a concrete thing. So our mayor has a cotton gin, and they, you know, there's big cotton fields there. You have a lot of cotton farmers. You have a lot of truckers. You know, a lot of the farmers supplement their income with trucking. The mayor also has an electrical company, but they do very concrete things. So they tend to be not divorced from reality because they're dealing with reality every day. Now, one of the things I heard every time I went to the East Coast and West Coast was how stupid everybody in Hickory Valley was. You know, and you get these books that write about the masses, and the masses are stupid, and the masses are, you know, and one of the things I discovered is they ain't stupid. I mean, I would take 10 of my neighbors in Hickory Valley and put them up against 10 people in Silicon Valley. Now, the Silicon Valley people probably test higher in IQ, but they have been so massively subsidized by government money, whereas the people in Hickory Valley their whole life have had to sell it for more than it costs to make it and have had to survive in, you know, in really tough times. And so they're much closer to reality and they're much more agile.
Yes.
But they have a way of dealing with the official narrative that somebody from the East Coast would say they're stupid. They're not stupid. They're smart like a fox. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Right. Oh, absolutely.
Right. And so if you live with real people, I mean, if you've known somebody who's had to feed their kids by cleaning Super 8 motels.
Yeah.
You know, my fantasy is to have Hillary Clinton work for 2 years cleaning Super 8 motels, and then she has to write an essay called "What Is a Deplorable?" Okay. But one of the things,
when we run the Marxist America, we'll send her to one of these reeducation camps.
So, but one of the things life has taught me is that every person is unique, and every person has something to offer.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Right. And there is no such thing as the masses. And if you look at how these mass things are promoted, it's a way of disparaging most people. And there's a lot of discussion in this book that denigrates people and makes them out to be stupid and makes them out to be not worth saving, not right. worth helping, not That's worth right. investing in. And that is the opposite, because if you look at what Mr. Global wants, Mr. Global wants control of the people. He doesn't care about money. He can print money out of thin air, right?
Yeah.
He wants to
yes.
control the people. Yeah. So he knows life is where the action is. But there is an inversion here that says the people are worthless. The people are stupid.
Yeah.
The people are easily manipulated. The whole message is people are not worth the effort.
Absolutely. I'm really enjoying this. I think it's going to help me even. I'm writing a new book, which is mostly about this.
Really? Oh, yes. Fabulous.
Oh, yes, I'll have to pass some of it by you. But
okay.
Yes, absolutely. And he does the same thing to the intellectuals by saying that people who were, you know, he would describe as intellectuals anyway, like me and you and other people who are concerned about the power structure. He says that we are just pursuing our unconscious needs. And that is just what the psychoanalysts did to their patients in order to right. control them. They had people who would sit and pay these sons of bitches for 6 days a week therapy, just lying on their backs, reassociating while the therapist said almost nothing. And they often then got very crazy, the people, because it was such a crazy making situation. And then they call that regression in the interest of therapy. So, I mean, they're
I would call it psychological castration.
Yes, it is.
Right.
It is terrible.
I would call mass formation psychological castration.
I like that.
Right.
I mean, it's, I don't like it, but it's right.
Okay, I'm with you. Because I normally wouldn't use that word, you know, unless I was talking to a vet, but, you know, anyway.
That's funny. I have to tell you this. I happened to pass by one of Mom's shows, which was a vet show last night.
Really?
The guy picked up a pig. And that he was going to do an operation on. And he said, first we castrate him, right in front of my eyes, splurting blood. Mom, that didn't bother her at all. Oh, God.
Yeah, did she grow up on a farm?
No, not really. She's just tough.
Yeah, okay.
She's just tough. Yeah. She grew up in Indiana, so she knew about... No, she didn't grow up in Indiana. She grew up in Long Island. But
okay, so let's close this out. What's the action? If you're at a cocktail party and somebody tries to persuade you that mass formation explains what's happening, what can you do? What do you say? What do you...
You may not like my answer. I think you look into yourself and say, what am I doing here at a cocktail party? And you leave. Because I think it will make you crazy to try to deal with these superficial people who are caught up in progressivism in the extreme and don't want to face evil. I would say work outside the cocktail party, work on those margins where right. you can convince your neighbor, affect the school board. But I honestly don't think you could formulate. Now, I actually went to a couple of cocktail parties 20 years ago when we moved here. We had some friends. And so I went to a couple of cocktail parties and just minding my business and having simple conversations with people who were very sweet progressives. And I would just make a simple point and they would scream, yell at
really?
Me, threaten me. Because I don't get overexcited. I'm like I am now. Uh-huh. And they've never heard these things before. And they would freak out. I remember one very sweet woman who was teaching economics at a small local college. And we're at a little party together. And I made it what I thought was a really important point. I thought she hadn't thought about. And she stood up and used the F word on me and screamed at me. So don't go to cocktail parties and try to be nice. Build outside the system. And what you're going to find if you move outside the system is exactly what you were describing. A lot of wonderful people.
Right.
And some of them are going to be smarter than the people who went to college. Some of them may have gone to college, but they're going to have good sense and they're going to be loving and they're going to do things that are worthwhile. They do a lot of, often they're in service jobs. They're actually serving people, taking care of people. Right. And we know a lot of people like that. And some of them work for us. They've come to us to help out and they've called us and said, could we work for you? And they're wonderful people. So get involved with this.
Right.
Movement.
So you have to reorganize your life to be in cahoots with people who are prepared to face and deal with evil.
Absolutely.
Right.
Don't try to even. And also, I wouldn't try to talk your family members into these things either, because you'll lose them completely. And better that you guys stay in friendly touch while they watch you do something very brave and maybe they'll learn from it. But
right.
good arguments freak out these people. So, I mean, you'd have to pander
The reason I ask this is I can't tell you some people I have tremendous respect for have picked up and promoted this idea. And I think it's because they haven't really explored it. They think, oh, well, people are behaving like they're in a trance or like they've been hypnotized. And that helps me understand the entrainment phenomena. And they don't realize what's underneath this.
Yeah.
You know, I just think
when people act abused, they've probably been abused. And we really have to understand that, folks. And when somebody is afraid to think, afraid to look, afraid to leave the house, afraid of what the authorities are going to do to them, the odds are overwhelming that somebody has organized that to happen to all these
right.
people.
Right.
And even with individuals, it's true. As a therapist, you learn that if somebody is freaked out, they've been freaked out by somebody, probably.
Right.
Mother, father, big brother, big sister.
Well, the reason people are afraid of being abused is because they're being abused.
That's exactly right.
I mean, in COVID-19, we just talked about a survey, Peter, where it's a U.S. survey done of landlords. 35% of small businesses say they didn't pay their rent in June.
Hmm.
That's abuse.
Yeah. And intentional. They want to get rid of the middle class.
Right. Right.
Again, I mean, it's like there's actually people doing this. And you've taught me about that. I mean,
a huge amount of work. It takes a huge amount of work.
Yeah. But you taught me about one of the reasons they have all these riots and things going on in the inner cities as part of the values drop. People have to sell their businesses and lo and behold, they're being bought up on block.
Right.
So, I mean, you really taught me about that kind of thing.
Yeah. The taxpayers pay to fund the riots. And then you pick the properties up for 10% on the dollar.
Yeah.
What could be better, right? Okay, well, Peter, I can't thank you enough for this.
Thank you.
I do think we have to tell people that you can face evil.
Yes.
And you can face it not alone. There are lots of us out
There's hundreds of thousands,
right.
millions of us in America.
And what I will say is, until you face it and break through that wall, you're not on a pathway to real solutions. which is why it's such a neurotic space, why it's such a space full of anxiety. So whatever your fear of facing evil, it's better to face it, because it's when you break through that things start to look up. You know, then you're on the road to real solutions.
Well, that's what the opening of the new book where I'm writing, and Ginger's also continuing to help with research. And I think she's going to have written some of the chapters too before we're done. But that's it. But you're a little more articulate, so I probably have to come back and listen to
so,
this.
So when can we hope for the book?
Well, I'll try to send you stuff as soon as I'm not embarrassed by its level. But I don't know. I've given up on the last time we did that. It took me an extra 8 months, and we had people that were really upset about not getting their book. And we ended up giving away the manuscripts in advance so that people would have the material ahead of time.
So okay, well, I don't want you to do that. So don't predict.
Won't be a long time. Won't be long.
But I look forward to it.
It's going to be a much smaller book. Okay.
Okay, Peter Bregan, the man who's faced down evil his whole life. Thank you for joining us on the Slayer Report. You have a wonderful day.
Oh, Catherine Austin Fitz, for being a dear friend, a brilliant woman who's taught me so much. And to see you smiling at me is just fabulous.
That's why. I love my job, because I associate with only the best people.
And you folks, you can do it on every level.
Yes.
Just get involved, and you're just going to find that on what you think is the lowest level of politics are going to be the nicest people, because they're not professionals. So get involved. Get involved.
One of my favorite scriptures, I have a lot of favorite scriptures, but there's one about, it's about faith, hope, and charity, the Corinthians phrase, and how you have to never do anything that would cause you to lose your faith and hope and love, that they have to be protected at all costs. But he's talking about how you can't tolerate certain things. And it very much fits with this theory of mass formation, you know, and my intolerance for it. He says, look, my elevator only goes to the first floor. If you're going to the basement, you can get off and take the stairs. So the psychology of totalitarianism, Matisse Desmet can get off and take the stairs. Peter Bregan, thank you very much. You have a wonderful evening.
And may you get lost in the basement.
Have a great evening, and my love to Ginger.
You too. Thank you so much, Kay. Bye.